Hey, good evening. I'm back. Good to see everyone. So a few weeks ago, you know, like a lot of you probably, we've been watching a number of films around here during the stay-at-home time, and we watched a film called The Last Black Man in San Francisco. This is kind of an art film, you know, it's not what you probably would, whatever you imagine that film might be, you're wrong. It's an unexpected experience. So, and an interesting film. And, toward the end of that film, there was a line that, really jumped out at me, and I kept repeating it in my mind until I could write it down. And the line was, let us have the courage to live beyond the stories that we are born into. Mm-hmm. Let us have the courage to live beyond the stories we are born into. And right now in America, because of the public torture and murder of George Floyd, the murder of Breonna Taylor, the murder of Maude Arbery, and many others, we're having a moment in our society where we're deeply introspecting the story that we have been born into, that we are born into in this country. And there's a mass movement called Black Lives Matter. I'm sure everyone knows that. That is trying to change this story and trying to focus on us on the racism that is at the heart of this story. Once again, based on the grief we feel and the intolerability of what we've seen, many people want to see our collective story change for good and change for better. As people practicing the Buddha Way, we welcome the awakening that we are seeing. We welcome the discussions about reforming the police so that they cause less violence and less harm. We welcome the discussion of priorities for public funding to serve underserved and poor communities, to reallocate resources to those communities. And as practitioners of the way, and as some of us, a lot of us in this call, as persons who are white, we welcome the invitation, or I hope anyway, we welcome the invitation that's been being extended for a while to introspect on the privileges that we have enjoyed as a result of being members of the race that has governed and controlled this society since its inception. I welcome the invitation to introspect on my story of being a white person in this country. And as people who practice the Buddha way, well, one thing I think we know is that it takes a great deal of effort to make a change. To change people's hearts takes a great deal of effort. To change our own hearts takes a great deal of effort. It's not something that we do overnight. It's something that we're called, and if we're called by practice, we're called to work on ourselves day by day, to work on our minds, to work on our consciousness day by day, to begin to understand, to constantly build an understanding of the ways in which our consciousness is creating suffering. Our very minds are creating suffering. And now we're being invited to introspect this on such a deep level, on a level that is so close to us, as close to us as our skin. When something is that close, it can be difficult to see that there's a story there. There's a story right there in my skin. We might not, it might take us a while to think, yes, there is a story there. There's a story that I really, it would do me good, and it would do our society good, and it would do others good for me to introspect that story that's so close as the color of my skin. In Buddhism, we have a term, it's called bodhicitta. Many of you are familiar with this term. Bodhi means awakening or enlightenment. Citta means mind or thought. So bodhicitta is the mind or thought of enlightenment. Mind or thought of awakening. Bodhicitta is an aspiration. It's an aspiration that we hold in our practice. And for this moment, I can think of no better definition of bodhicitta than having the courage to live beyond, arousing the mind of enlightenment, to live beyond the stories that we have been born into. I think that's a wonderful definition of bodhicitta. And you could say that this is why people, you know, this aspiration, this aspiration to live beyond our stories is why people take up practice, why many people take up practice in the first place. I think most people who take up practice, have some feeling that, the story I have about myself might not be the best story, a story that I feel I really chose, that I really wanted, but actually maybe it's a story that some other people wanted for me, or it's a story that I just absorbed but didn't really think about. And so many people who take up practice have some feeling like, I think I need to introspect this story that I'm living by. And maybe it's a story of maybe there's a lot of fear in this story, or maybe there's a lot of angst in this story. Usually there's something, for a lot of people anyway, there's usually something in the story of things not being right. And things aren't right. Things aren't right now. And we know that. So we really need, you know, this practice of living beyond our stories. Last month, I took a week-long class. This was a class on the internet, and this week-long class was with a professor from Smith College back in Massachusetts. His name is Jay Garfield, and he is one of the, I would say, one of the foremost Western scholars of the and he's a particular a scholar of the philosophical schools of Buddhism known as Yogacara and Madhyamaka. And he's written extensively on this over many years, thought deeply about it. He's really, really quite a brilliant person, and I think, you know, well, very well studied in these, these philosophical schools. And so I've been attracted to his work for many years, but found it rather impenetrable. So I was moved to take this class online with him that was that Susan Farrar made me aware of. And it was quite worthwhile. It was a big commitment, but it was quite worthwhile. And during the course of that class, Jay Garfield brought up an editorial that a friend of his, another philosopher, had written just in those few days. He had written an editorial in the New York Times, and this fellow's name, who wrote the editorial, is named George Yancey, and he is African American, and he is a professor at Emory College in Atlanta. And he wrote an editorial for the New York Times after the murder of Ahmaud Arbery. And maybe you know that story. Ahmaud Arbery was out for a run in his neighborhood, a jog, and he was accosted by two white men who took out after him, confronted him, and in the course of that confrontation, shot him to death. Ahmaud Arbery was out running, and he was black. So in his mind, in the minds of his assailants, he was a danger. He was suspicious by virtue of being a black man running. Orlando Castillo was driving home with his girlfriend from work. He was stopped by a police officer and shot to death. He was driving while black. Tamir Rice was playing on a swing. The police were called. He was shot to death. He was playing while black. Breonna Taylor was asleep in her bed when the police burst in to her room, to her apartment, and shot her to death. She was sleeping while black. We need to be speaking about this. Everyone in every event like this needs to be speaking about this. This is intolerable. This has to be stopped. George Yancey's point in the editorial that he wrote for the New York Times was that the ideology of racism is an ideology. It's a belief system. It's a way that consciousness has been shaped in people in this country, and it's been shaped, of course, more fixedly in some people. But it's a pervasive ideology. And his point was that due to this ideology, or the outcome of this ideology, is that there are people in the white race who believe that they have the right to control black bodies. They have the right to do what they want with black bodies. This was the point he was making in the editorial. For many years, black intellectuals, going back at least to James Baldwin, I'm sure before that, but black intellectuals and leaders have been asking us, as the dominant race, to introspect on this ideology, the attitudes and the underlying causes and conditions that create this ideology, that create the belief system called white supremacy. And intellectual leaders in the black community, leaders on the streets, are really asking us to please look at this. Why do we need this ideology? What is it serving? And to ask us to look at the harm it's causing, to look at the loss of innocent life, to look at the great overreaction, people dying for such, the punishment being administered essentially on the streets, the sentence carried out on the streets. And people, they've been asking us to look at this for years, and we need to look at it. This is the time, if there ever was a time, to have the courage to look beyond the stories that we have been born into, this story of white supremacy, this story of racism. You need to look at this story. Now, of course, you know, in our Buddhist, you know, understanding, these stories are born and carried out in consciousness, in the mind, right? And mind has a way of being transmitted from grandfather to son, and son to his son, and so forth. Minds have a way of being transmitted, of being carried forward. Ideologies are embedded in minds, and they have a way of being carried forward. And what we're being called to do is say, it ends with me. It ends right here. It shall not endure anymore. It can't go on. It won't go on with me. It won't go on with my children. And I know many of you, all of you, believe this and understand this and want this. And we need to be speaking about it, and we need to be making change that enacts a different story in our society. In our teaching, the consciousness that sees and grasps subject-object duality is called mundane consciousness or naive consciousness. The way things are seen in mundane consciousness is as we imagine them to be, as we imagine them to be, not as they really are. Mundane consciousness does not take into account the biases that have been layered into consciousness by evolution, by history, by our gender identity, by our social and familial status, by our so-called race, all of which have shaped us. These biases have shaped us, but mundane consciousness doesn't see them. It doesn't recognize them. It just takes what has been constructed, what has been constructed by consciousness and by consciousness that have come before for us. It takes what those things have that have been constructed as really real, as for granted, as of course. This is the way it is. Yet mundane consciousness sees the color of a person's skin, and then, on the basis of that, sees vast difference between a person of one color and another color. It discriminates vast difference, even though every human being shares approximately 94% of their DNA with every other human being. That's the amount of difference that there really is. Maybe about 6% difference. But consciousness, mundane consciousness, which is trained to see difference, takes the superficial color and says, that's everything. That's 100%. That makes us completely different. So mundane consciousness, our consciousness, is deceptive. It's not telling us the real story. And this is why we practice. We practice because we're interested in the real story. What's the real story here? And the real story, in Chinese, there's no word for race in Chinese. No word. And the scientists tell us race is a fiction. Race is actually a fiction. It doesn't exist. It's a made up, it's a human construct. It has nothing to do with biology. Nothing to do with humanity. But we've made it, we somehow, because of our, not somehow, it's obvious how we've done it, through our constructed consciousness, we've made it into something really, really real. And on the basis of which, immeasurable harm, immeasurable suffering, immeasurable violence has been inflicted. There's a story in our Zen teaching of a famous teacher. His name is Dongshan. And we've talked about Dongshan quite a bit. He's a famous Zen ancestor, particularly beloved by our Soto school of Zen. One of the founders, considered one of the founders of our Soto school of Zen. So there's a story, very short story about Dongshan. He was going to leave his teacher, Yunyan, who he'd been studying with for some time, although we don't really know how long. But he had been there, and they had gotten close. But Dongshan felt like it's time for me to go around and see some other teachers. So he was going to depart from Yunyan. And in his parting exchange with his teacher, he asked the teacher, after I've gone away, and if someone asks me about you, if they ask me what you were like, how should I talk about you? What should I say? What should I say about you? How should I betray your likeness, is the way it's stated in the story. How should I portray your likeness? How should I paint your picture? And his teacher Yunyan said, just this person. Just this person. So I really understand Yunyan's response there is saying, I'm a person who really, I just really, what I'm mainly concerned with is being authentic. I really just want to be who I am. I don't want to be fooled. I don't want to be fooled. I want to live truly. I want to live carefully. I want to deeply introspect my story. And I want to introspect it in a way that is helpful to others, beneficial to others, thinks of the welfare of others, that doesn't put myself over all, over others, but actually puts others first. I want to be like that. I want to be a true person of the way, a careful person, person interested in not causing harm, causing benefit. I want to cause benefit if I can. I want to think of the welfare of others. That's what I really want to be. Just this person who's true to being just this. So we have a method. You know, in this school, we have a method for being a true person. And it's called Zazen. Zazen is our method for being a true, authentic person. Sitting still. Sitting upright. Not being fooled. Letting go of objects of thought. Letting go of the thinker of thoughts. Just sitting, we call it. Just sitting in non-dual awareness. Not leaning into the subject, not leaning into the object, not leaning into others, not leaning into yourself. Just so, just being so, just this is it, just this, not being a true person of the way, being an authentic person of the way. That is Zazen, non-dual awareness, sitting upright, letting go of the past, letting go of the future, and letting go of all our stories, all of our stories, but especially harmful stories, with a special emphasis on stories that denigrate others, that denigrate the self, that put ourselves down, that put others down. And the best way, you know, if you see those stories, good. I mean, that's part of your practice. You see those stories. You see those false, deceptive stories. But you introspect those stories. And you let go of those stories. And being a person of the way is having the courage, like the expression in the film says, having the courage to live beyond our stories. I think this practice is extremely relevant today, right now. We really need to be doing this practice. We really need to see how constructed our reality is. And because we can construct reality, we can construct a new reality. We can work toward constructing a new reality in this country. We can put our best foot forward, as small as we are, as little as our effort may be, one drop in the bucket. But there is something that we can do. There's something, some way we can help. There's some way we can support changing the story of racism and white supremacy in this country. And I have to say, I think we just must do this. We just must help. And, you know, this is our practice this is Mahayana Buddhism. Mahayana Buddhism distinguishes itself by its effort to save all beings. Its vow to practice for the benefit of all beings, leaving no one out. Destroying all bias. Leaving it all behind. And envisioning, you know, this is a vision we have and we hold in our practice. This is a path of vision. So let's have a path of vision. Let's have a path of vision that is not based on a deceptive, divisive ideology. Let's have a path of vision. And George Yancey says this. I've since got one of his books and I've been reading it. And like Martin Luther King, he says, I'm offering love. I'm offering love as the alternative. I'm inviting love. And that is a really remarkable statement. I'll stop here in a minute, but I just want to tell you one more story. George Yancey wrote a letter previously to the New York Times, or an op-ed, and it was called Letter to White America. And in that letter, he brought forth some of these arguments the perspective of, you know, asking white America, which we're being asked over and over by various people, to examine our whiteness, examine privilege, examine how racism is perpetuated. So he's in that letter to white America. He asked this again. He strongly suggested, he invited, I think his word, he said, and this is a gift. This is a gift I'm giving you. That's what he said. It's a gift of love. It's a gift motivated by love. Because he's basically saying, and this will make you better. So that's a pretty remarkable thing. That's a pretty remarkable thing for an African American man in this society to say. And the really devastating fact is that after he wrote this editorial, he received innumerable hate mail from racist people using the full panoply of racist epithets and denigrating him in every possible way. He also received support, of course, you know, from people, right-minded, good-minded people, but he received a tremendous amount of racist hate mail. He is in Georgia, which I'm afraid may have more work to do, maybe, than we do in the West Coast, but certainly we have work to do here, but he is in Georgia, and doubly brave of him to write that editorial from that state, which has a terrible history of violence. And violence against African Americans. But nevertheless, you know, he then wrote a book called Backlash, which I got, and he describes all this. After he wrote this editorial, he describes all the invective he received. But he put forward a vision. He put forward a vision that was based on love and based on healing, and based on nonviolence. And that's the vision I would like to leave you with tonight is let us go forward with a story of love and nonviolence and healing. And find a way to change that other story and not let it continue to infect and cause harm in our country. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Jim. And this is a time for open conversation. And I am going to leave everyone muted just to keep out background noise so you can unmute yourself and raise your hand if you would like to speak. Barbara, just unmute yourself.
Here we go. We're talking about nothing short of changing consciousness. And it's a tall order. Although we do take a vow to not put self above others. And that to me is really kind of the heart of racism. And this conversation for me invites me to look at all of the areas where prejudice occurs in my life. Not just racism, but where we put self above others. Because every time we do that, we create the environment in which prejudice that shows up as racism exists. So I've been using this as an opportunity to look at all those places that I stiffen up when encountering others. All those places where I habitually put self above others and accepting that this is not just a time for people with overt racist views to change. But this is a time for all of us to look at the places where prejudice occurs in our lives and accept that those prejudices add to this environment of racism.
Thank you. Oscar, would you like to speak, Oscar?
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Jim, for that heartfelt and moving and precise talk. I was reminded of when I think about racism sometimes and my own background and training and conditioning. Sometimes I think of a story that Reb tells about Suzuki Roshi at Tassajara in a lecture one time referring to his disciples. And Reb asked him, "Who are your disciples, Roshi?" Of course, he wanted to know, "Am I one of your disciples?" And Suzuki Roshi said, I wish I didn't think like this. I wish I didn't think like this. But the ones who are here to help others, not they're my disciples." And of course, that's the Mahayana aspiration. But what I like about this story, what helps me about this story, what gives me refuge in that story, is that Suzuki Roshi, a great founding teacher in America, also had to remind himself, I wish I didn't think like this. I have to be aware that I think like this so that it doesn't I don't cause suffering. So I just wanted to pass on that story because I feel it can be helpful. Thank you.
Thank you.
In Rev's book, I think we read that story. That story was in the recent book we read, maybe.
Maybe.
On the Paramitas. And I think Rev said too, he said, "I still wonder about that, view that, Suzuki Roshi, expressed." You know, he said, "I still wonder about it." Because, it almost seemed like it left some people out. But I think Suzuki Roshi, as you're implying, acknowledged that, I see this as a little one-sided, but I'm confessing that I'm one-sided.
Yeah. Exactly.
And part of this struggle that we have in this moment is, we have to, how do we deal with confession? It's really how do we confess our own racism, our own prejudices, and how do we work with that? It's not simple. It's not easy. And there don't seem to be, it's not clear, what venues, are appropriate to work in. I mean, I'm working in some areas where I think it might be helpful, but, it's only in a kind of a very, it's a, not short term. It's, long term, more systemic kind of change.
I've been reflecting again on, I think, can't remember the material that helped me see this, but to understand that part of white privilege is that we can stay silent. There are, and in fact, staying silent perpetuates the structures of white supremacy. And so I notice when I feel like I could speak up in certain contexts where I might be confronting a racist view, I get like a tension in the pit of my stomach. I feel this dread, and that tells me, you know, that the courage includes this discomfort of not hiding, I guess, behind my whiteness.
Yeah. The vulnerability, right? I mean, to be vulnerable in these kinds of situations is, you know, as you're pointing out, that is part of the price, you know, we pay if we choose not to be silent.
Thank you. Any other comments, perspectives? Peter, you want to unmute yourself?
I want to unmute myself. Thank you. I have quite a bit to say, and I'm not going to say it now, but in short, I do see our society, myself included, we are filled with people who are basically addicted to comfort. It's easy for me to just point at our exercise. You know, those of us who do go jogging or bicycling or working out, we mostly don't work out as hard and as vigorously as we could, as it could benefit us. Similarly, keeping silent is an act of comfort. It's like, I'm not intruding by speaking up and saying, that doesn't work for me. You know, it's like, I really wish you didn't behave that way. And, you know, listening to them tell me that what I do doesn't work for them. We do frequently get addicted to comfort and be silent. And so I just want to point out that I really do think it's a good, I love dance. You know, when we dance, especially when we learn to dance, we step on each other's feet. And in doing so, we might get offended, but it really is important to realize that while we're in the path of learning and starting to dance and trying something new, it's not going to be so smooth. I'll use the analogy of, we're all in a cold room. It's 55 degrees, and it would be much better if it were 65. So we could simply turn up the thermostat and watch us go from 55 through 6, 7, 60 degrees, in a linear line, and we can see we're getting warmer. It's not going to be like that as we correct ourselves from our own bias, which is much more like pulling, you know, having the courage to live outside of stories that we don't even see. They're so real that we don't recognize them as stories. So we barely know what it means to correct these stories. It is going to be frightening. There is going to be stepping on each other's toes and a lot of mistakes. You know, everything I'm saying right now is probably 20% wrong at least. Hopefully it's at least 50% correct. I'm hoping that, you know, those people who hear me and see and can discern where I'm incorrect will at least go with the core of my message, and that we will all go with the core of each other's messages and have faith that while we are constantly making mistakes, we are hopefully doing a lot that's correct at the same time.
Yeah. So hopefully we're, you know, the intent of all of our speech is to encourage each other, is to encourage each other to have the courage, to have the courage to speak up, to have the courage to, you know, be in the situations we're in, and if there's a way to help, not be shy, not step away, and you know, this is essentially, I don't know what, you know, if there's more that we can do or not, but those are things that we can do to, you know, just encourage, you know, the point of me talking here, the point of our getting together, the whole point of it is to encourage us, you know, in this kind of bravery mind, you know, the bravery mind of practice, to really see things as they are, you know, and, you know, some of the, insights that you have, are, you know, painful to have. They're painful to have some of the insights that we have about ourselves and about our attitudes and so forth. But to have those insights and to not then use them as a club against yourself, but actually as a source of healing is really the essence of practice.
And it won't always look linear. I just need to explain why I brought up the thermostat. We're going to sometimes appear to go in the wrong direction, and we just have to have faith that things will work out. If we keep listening and keep fighting for what we believe in, we will get in the proper direction. But frankly, we really don't know what it's going to take to get to where we need to go. We just have faith that we're all doing it together.
There was a cute phrase that Jay Garfield, I mentioned the class that I was taking with him, and he described, you know, our direction, our path of practice as adding insight to injury. Adding insight to injury, you see? So this is a very cute little phrase, but it's a very accurate phrase. There's a lot of injury. There's a lot of injury that's occurred, a tremendous amount. Adding insight to it, as George Yancey is trying to do, as so many black leaders are trying to do, as so many corporations even. I mean, this is kind of a tremendous moment, you know, in our collective history, where people have seen something that they just absolutely cannot accept, they cannot tolerate, and they really are want to extend beyond the usual, you know, thoughts and prayers. You know, it's everybody knows it's not enough, and it is kind of an amazing moment. And let's, you know, I hope it keeps going. Well, it seems maybe that we are come to the end of our evening, unless there's some other comment. I'll lead us out in the Richard, you'd like to say?
Oh, I was just going to ask if you can, I guess, send the name of those two articles that you read or found.
Sure.
Yes.
Yeah, I think I can find the editorial that George Yancey wrote, and what was the other one that I can send the name of the book he wrote about his letter to white America. I'll send that as well.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
I'd like to, this is Oscar. I'd like to just, in regard to George Yancey, I'd like to express my gratitude, Jim, to you for pointing out something he said, which is that in his op-ed piece for the Times, he said he was making an offering, a gift, presenting a gift. And it reminded me of what Reb has often said in similar ways. And I'd like to endorse that practice, because when in confrontational or potentially confrontational situations, I've reviewed my motivation and concluded that I was offering a gift. My fear was no longer a factor in the conversation, and I was offering the gift of conversation. So I'm familiar with that fear, and I offer that, and so it was nice to hear Mr. Yancey's view that he also shares the desire to offer gifts to the world. Thank you.
Russ?
Yeah, hi. So I was a little reluctant to speak because after your talk, I was feeling pretty emotional. It kind of hit me right in the heart. I think also because I watched the press conference this morning of Rayshard Brooks with his family at the podium, his wife and one of his sons, his youngest daughter, his brothers and sisters were there. And if you really want to, educate yourself on the experience of Black America, I highly suggest watching that press conference today. It really, it made me cry. I almost felt like after hearing your talk tonight. I mean, it's great to educate ourselves with books and movies, which we need to do from the Black experience. But that press conference today just hit me really hard. And it really just let me, the impact of the Black experience, I've never felt it as strongly as I did this morning. So that's all I'd like to share.
Who was that interview with?
It was the Rayshard Brooks. I should have put this in context. He's the man who was killed in Georgia Friday night at a drive-thru when he fell asleep, and the police officers woke him up and confronted him, and it went peacefully at first, but then it went south very quickly, and they ended up killing him.
This is what has to be addressed all across the country, is this disproportional response. It has to be addressed, and we really have to look at our, we're in such a pickle here. We're just in such a pickle. Mm-hmm.